2009. You have been much by the dark river, so near to us all, and have seen so many embark that dread of the old boatmen has almost disappeared. Sir William Osler, Equanimitas. The best sentinels to discover a new disease are doctors who have a beer together after work and talk shop. Source unknown. Chapter 1, Wednesday, January 21, 2009, 6:05 p.m. International Pacific Time, USS Ronald Reagan, Nimitz-class carrier, CVN 76. 10 corpses lay in the meat locker below deck. 2 men behind him carried an 11th. Unlocking the makeshift morgue, he walked in on what looked like an orgy, the dead who were already there having slid into each other's embrace from the roll of the giant vessel. No one had thought to tie them down. Their poses were all the more suggestive under the partial cover of disheveled shrouds. Back to back, belly to belly, it's the zombie jamboree, an ensign who lugged the head end muttered. Shut up, his partner whispered, and they deposited the newest resident on the floor. You want us to straighten this tangle up, sir? What Dr. Paul Wilson wanted was to get out of there. He shook his head and waved the two men back into the corridor. Seconds later, he was rushing to where he could find fresh air. Onboard gamblers had given 3-1 odds that the body count would reach 12 before dawn. No takers bet against them, and everyone watched each other while going about their duties, probably wondering who would kill whom this time. Some grim-faced wags joked that the next murderer might even turn out to be themselves. Nobody laughed. He stumbled up the last stairwell and stepped outside. 90,000 tons of hull shuddered, then rose beneath his feet, forcing him to grip the rail of the smoker's promenade, a long balcony tucked under the port side of the flight deck. The lurch itself couldn't throw him overboard. He'd have to help it along with a jump to achieve that. What nearly toppled him had been the nauseating swirl in his head, not suicidal intent. At least, not yet. A shadow scurried deeper into the darkness behind him, one of the phantoms that had recently taken up residence along the edges of his vision. A vanishing leg, the flash of an arm, a darting rat, they skirted his days only to become bolder at night. Lack of sleep, he told himself. To be expected at the end of a 6-month stretch in the world's last remaining but most enduring war zone. Nothing that wouldn't clear up once he got off this floating nuthouse. He focused on the gray walls of water 3 stories high that surged out from the fog. They split themselves in two at the bow, then sizzled along the hull, their briny spittle licking at the steel in long, curling tongues. He understood how primitive mariners on ancient vessels could peer over the side, down into the twisting, hissing foam, and create phantoms of their own, usually in the form of sea serpents. A wind squall plucked at his uniform, and he shivered, finding the early evening gloom unusually chilly for the tropics. Beyond the colorless sphere where visibility ended, sea bled into murky dusk, and the rest of the ship loomed into shadow. The emptiness out there sucked at him, as if threatening to pull him into its void, portending obliteration. He tightened his hold on the rail, and, for the first time in his life, understood the terrors of those who suffered from agoraphobia, the fear of open spaces. Yet he stayed put. Better the bracing wetness of spray, rain, and mist in his face than go inside. There the walls of his steel warren would close in and squeeze him until he couldn't breathe. But why? Navy veteran, ship surgeon, chief medical officer to 5,000 crews since the vessel's maiden shakedown cruise in 2003. He'd never been bothered by open sea or cramped quarters before. The prisoner has been brought to sickbay, ready for you to examine him, sir, a female voice said from behind his back. He'd released his grip on the railing and started to turn toward her when his entire left arm began to tremble. The blur of white fingers, as he failed to bring them under control, disgusted him. "I'll be along in a minute," he said, and grabbed the rail again, hoping the woman wouldn't notice. Outwardly, the shaking stopped, but he could still feel the muscles jumping beneath his skin, like frog legs connected to a battery. "I don't know why I did it, sir," the 19-year-old said. His ID badge read Billy Johnson, and his boyish features were stretched white with earnest bewilderment. Until today, his record as an ensign had been spotless, sitting on the examining table, stripped to his boxer shorts, wrists cuffed, ankles shackled. He looked puny and had remained completely docile from the moment they'd subdued him. He'd also been desperately polite, as if a show of good manners might undo the carnage of his 60-second rampage. A few hours ago, down in the engine room, he'd grabbed a lug wrench and cracked open the skull of a second lieutenant who'd ordered him to wipe up an oil spill. Before the MPs could pull him off, his victim's head resembled a hollowed-out melon, the kind with a decorative zigzag cut around its edge and used to hold fruit salad at fancy buffets, except this offering contained shards of bone protruding from a white and gray puree of brain matter. The 10 others in the morgue had been killed under similar circumstances, each a victim of inexplicable, out-of-proportion rage. And 10 other murderers were in shackles below decks, each as stunned by what they'd done as the one who sat before him now. It had all occurred during the last 7 days. "Hold out your hands, Billy," Paul ordered. The young man complied. It wasn't obvious, but to a trained eye, the fingers had a tiny vibration. Paul once more clasped the promenade rail with both hands and breathed in the night air. He kept turning over in his mind what he'd done and what he should have done. A dark shape flitted along the back of the promenade. He swung around and saw nothing. He glanced right and left. Nobody near enough to worry about. He turned back to face the sea. Despite armed MPs stationed about the ship, he watched his back, especially out here and above all, among those wearing the signature wool-lined leather jackets of flyboys. They had it in for him because he'd decked them. Not that the other ranks were any more sociable. Everyone remained snarly, suspicious, and hostile. Even those who lined the railing with him kept to themselves, shoulders hunched up as much against company as the damp. Little wonder. People had disappeared from this very spot. Maybe they leapt to escape private demons, but rumors circulated that some had been thrown. He glanced over his shoulder again. This time not even a shadow stirred. Of course, there were those on board who'd try and harm him in other ways than with a lug wrench. They'd say that he'd been incompetent, had covered up his own problems while denying the need to get help himself. Well, just let them try. He'd taken precautions on that front, logged everything, made detailed entries in the clinical charts of anyone who'd shown symptoms. He looked at his watch. The whole mess would soon be PACOM's problem anyway. It was their medical officers at Pearl who'd agreed that the Reagan could push on to port where they'd sort everything out. "Commander Wilson, sir?" He pivoted about, hands raised defensively in front of his face as if to ward off a blow. A young woman wearing the insignia of second lieutenant stood at attention a safe distance away. He immediately lowered his guard. "Yes?" "The captain requests your presence on the bridge right away, sir. There's been another incident."
"Incident?"
"Argument, sir."
An icy burn ignited in the core of his slightly protruding gut. The growing number of shouting matches on the bridge had been the one set of events that he hadn't put on report. He should have, but the captain had pressured him to cover them up. No surprise there. The bridge was a captain's most immediate turf. He'd be held responsible for a failure to rein in undisciplined squabbling amongst his officers anywhere on the USS Reagan, but especially on the bridge. "Anybody hurt?" Paul said, preparing to hear the worst. "First Lieutenant Peterson has a bloody nose, sir." He let out a long breath. Thank God no one was dead. Still, this could be trouble with the brass if they investigated and found out the full extent of what he'd kept under wraps. "Well then, that's not very serious, is it?" he said, affecting a breezy manner. When dealing with a screw-up that could be a career breaker, minimize, minimize, minimize.
"Well, actually, sir, it is pretty serious. The reason First Lieutenant Peterson got popped on the nose is that he misread the global positioning satellite readings, then crashed the tracking system trying to override it with bad data. Some of the officers took exception, sir. They wanted him busted for incompetence. That's why the captain sent for you, to declare Peterson medically unfit."
"Not fix his nose," Paul said, allowing himself a slight smile. It seemed he could handle this one easily enough.
"That too, sir." They started toward the nearest stairwell.
"So there's no problem to navigate home?" he asked, just to make sure that all was once again well on the bridge. The woman flushed, but said nothing and quickened her stride, pulling slightly ahead of him. "Lieutenant," he said, expecting an answer. From a few steps behind, he saw the sides of her cheeks glow crimson. She entered a corridor leading under the carrier's tower. He picked up his pace and followed at her heels, trying to steady the familiar flutter of his heart as the walls pressed in on him. "Answer me, Lieutenant." She swallowed. "Permission to speak off the record, sir?" "Go ahead." She looked behind her to make sure no one else had followed them into the passageway. It was empty. "Sir, when the captain threatened to relieve First Lieutenant Peterson, the lieutenant accused the captain of being equally unfit for duty. He claimed the man gives an order for a course correction, then repeats it a minute later, as if he's forgotten the first one. It apparently happened several times tonight." Oh, Jesus, Paul thought. Not again. "But we're on course now, aren't we?" He wanted to slam the lid on this fast. She looked at him in surprise. "I suppose so. Lieutenant Peterson said something about we'd have been up Shit Creek if the other officers on watch hadn't pointed out both his and the captain's errors. So I guess that meant they corrected all the mistakes." "Well then, no harm, no foul, right?" "Pardon?" "Everything's worked out fine. I wouldn't make a big deal of it. As for poor First Lieutenant Peterson, he's obviously suffered the same breakdown that's taken everyone else. We can't put much stake in what he says." She looked puzzled, but nodded. As he followed her up several flights of stairs, instead of worrying about the woman keeping her mouth shut, he found himself admiring how slinkily her ass moved under her uniform. Christ, he was old enough to be her father. That was another change. He kept getting horny. When she wasn't looking, he opened a small vial of the Ativans he'd come to rely upon and slipped two of them under his tongue. It was only the third time today, he reassured himself, but then wasn't so certain of the count. Shadowy movements off in the darker corners of the stairwell continued to plague him, and on one landing, he glimpsed the bristly leg of a giant spider before it scuttled out of sight.